Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May and I'm joined by Michael Buzzy, Randy Olson, and very special guest Sandra Weber, who's joining us from New York, the Adirondack Mountains. This show is a very special show and it's a part of a series, the first part of a series devoted to something that happened 100 years ago, which was the unveiling of the portrait monument, the statue to Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And Sandra Weber is absolutely the world's expert on this statue. She is the author of this wonderful book that I've read several times, and it's The Gift That Keeps on Giving, The Woman Suffrage Statue, A History of Adelaide Johnson's Portrait Monument at the United States Capitol. So we'll be talking today about Sandra's research and also really about an important encounter that led to the statue. And that is the encounter between the sculptress, Adelaide Johnson, and Susan B. Anthony. Monday is the birthday of Susan B. Anthony, and it also marks the 100th anniversary of when the statue is unveiled in the United States Capitol in the Rotunda. And that is why we are doing these shows. Today, actually, February 11th, 100 years ago, was the day on which the statue was actually hauled into the Capitol. And in Sandra's book, there's a wonderful picture on page 94 of the transport of this huge statue into the Capitol. So we'll be talking about Sandra's research, some things that she learned through consulting the archives. And when we come back, we'll have a special show on Monday, which is the 100th anniversary. We'll go more into the statue itself. The statue is, there's so many important stories connected to it, as well as the persons that are in the statue. So thank you for learning about this really important statue. And Sandra, thank you so much for being here and sharing your expertise about the statue.
It's my pleasure.
Right. So this show and this dialogue has been a long time in the making, but not as long as Adelaide Johnson's portrait monument. And I really want to begin, Sandra, with how you became interested in women's history, because as we'll see, this focus on the statue emerged out of this interest. So can you just talk about how we use this phrase on the show, entering the forest, or how did you enter the forest? So how did you begin into this ocean of information about women's history? How did that happen for you?
Well, I love that you call it entering the forest, because that is exactly how it started for me, by entering the forest of the Adirondacks. And I did that as I was interested in hiking. I don't have a background in history or English. I have a math, computer science, business background, but I fell in love with the Adirondacks. And as I started hiking there, I became interested in, women are only mentioned, you know, very occasionally, but I had two daughters and I wanted my daughters to be aware of strong Adirondack women. So I started researching the history of a mountain. At that time, the only one of the big mountains here, but that was named for a woman, and it was named Esther Mountain. And it was named after some 15-year-old girl who supposedly got lost. She was trying to climb a different mountain and she ended up on this unnamed mountain, and she survived and her family found her. So they named the mountain for her and it became Esther Mountain. So that was the first research I did, and it turned into a book. And then I, you know, there was another mountain named for a woman, Mount Joe, and I searched for her story. And then there was the biggest mountain, Mount Marcy, which isn't actually named for a woman. It was named for the governor, Governor Marcy. But what I researched there really was were the stories of the women who had climbed Mount Marcy, which, you know, again, the women weren't talked about in the history books. So I had to do a lot of research finding who were the first women who climbed it. What did they wear? What did they do when they got to the top? And as I started doing this, I realized that I just had a passion for history and for doing this historical research, and just very interested in discovering, unearthing these stories of women that were there. You just kind of had to dig for them a little bit. And so I kind of left my other career behind and dove into this full time. And a friend of mine, Peggy Lynn, who's an Adirondack folk singer, she had been singing songs about Adirondack women. And we got together and wrote a whole book. We interviewed and researched 25 different women in the Adirondacks. And we wrote a book called Breaking Trail, Remarkable Women of the Adirondacks. And that just kind of, you know, exploded me into this whole area of the history of women and how did, you know, there's all these wonderful stories to tell. And one of those women that I profiled in that book was Inez Mulholland. And she was famous as the woman on the white horse leading the 1913 Washington, D.C. parade, where it ended up being a big riot. And Inez, you know, was a very famous suffragist. And she died in 1916, actually campaigning for women's right to vote. So she became the martyr of the suffrage movement. And it turns out that she's buried just like 5 miles up the road from my house in the Adirondacks. And so I became very, very interested in Inez. And I, you know, wrote another book about hiking with my daughters related to history, but Inez like always stuck with me. And it's really Inez that led me to learning about the suffrage statue. I was not aware of it. I was not aware of it having been brought back up to the rotunda in the U.S. Capitol. You know, it kind of folded into that. But I do want to getting back to this idea of the forest. That kind of came full circle for me because, as I said, I entered the forest of the Adirondacks and I wrote about mountains that have been named for women. But the end of that circle was that a little over a year ago, I was involved with an effort and we renamed a small mountain near my house here and we renamed it Mount Inez for Inez Mulholland.
Amazing. So, and this book that you wrote about 25 women. So when was that? What year was that?
That was 2004, I believe.
Okay, 2004. And so, I mean, you've named this mountain a Mount Inez, but you stumbled upon her not because she climbed any mountain, I presume, but because her house is nearby.
Yes, her family summer estate is very near here. Yes.
Okay. Amazing. So I just want to see if anybody, the other co-hosts, have any follow-up questions or comments.
Not yet. My things are associated with the statue, which we're going to get to.
Okay. All right. Well, then moving on. So you learn about Inez. And that leads you to the statue. And actually, page one, paragraph one, in the preface of your book, you write about how this happens. And I was just wondering if you could read that, those couple of sentences, Sandra, and then talk more about how Inez led you to the statue.
Absolutely. While researching the life of suffrage martyr Inez Mulholland, I stumbled across a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay. A footnote to the sonnet, which was dedicated to Mulholland, indicated that it had been read at the unveiling of a woman's monument in 1923. As often happens, the note caught my attention and I rambled off on a sidetrack. I learned more about the monument, such as it was actually unveiled in 1921, and began to sense its significance and convoluted life. So I saw that and I said, well, what's this connection between Mulholland and Millay? What's this connection with this women's monument? And how did all that fit together? Well, let me start with this. Inez ran off to Europe and got married in 1913 to Eugene Boissevain. I think it's the Hollander. And she was very happy. They had a very open marriage and whatever. But so Inez dies in 1916. A few years later, her husband remarries, and he remarries another woman, another Vassar graduate, Edna St. Vincent Millay. So what a guy he must have been. It's all I can think, right? I just have to go off on another sidetrack here. When I was researching at the Library of Congress, there's actually a real banker's check that Eugene wrote out to Edna St. Vincent Millay. And he wrote it out in the amount of 1 million hugs and 300 kisses. So back to my story. So Edna St. Vincent Millay in 1923 was asked to come to this ceremony that was being held in Washington, D.C. And part of the ceremony was an Inez memorial. And so she was asked to write a poem or whatever she felt for this ceremony because of her relationship to the Mulholland. And there was a lot of confusion afterwards in later years, because 5 years later, the sonnet was originally named To the Pioneers. And 5 years later, she renamed it To Inez. And so, as you know, as history and the years have gone along, everyone just assumed it was written about Inez. But this beautiful sonnet never quite made sense to me, because the first line is, up on this marble bust that is not I. And so I wondered, why is Edna talking about this marble bust when she's talking about Inez? And of course, as I looked into it, Edna actually originally wrote the sonnet about the statue. And it's later that she came to see it more as a tribute to Inez and renamed it. So it's just fascinating. I'd like to go ahead and read that sonnet if I can.
Oh, I would love for you to do that. Please do so.
So Edna St. Vincent Millay read the sonnet that she has composed as a tribute to the pioneers. Up on this marble bust that is not I, lay the round formal wreath that is not fame. But in the forum of my silenced cry, root ye the living tree whose sap is flame. I that was proud and valiant am no more, save as a wind that rattles the stout door, troubling the ashes in the sheltered grate. The stone shall perish, I shall be twice dust, only my standard on a taken hill can cheat the mildew and the red-brown rust and make immortal my adventurous will. Even now the silk is tugging at the staff, take up the song, forget the epitaph. And I just think that sonnet just so encapsulates the meaning of the portrait monument, because it's not about the I, it's not about individual women. We will all be passed and be turned to dust, but our message is what's important. You need to take up the song and finish the unfinished work and the message of the women's movement.
Amazing. And I just want to, you know, you read this page one, paragraph one from your book, and you were reading a footnote to the sonnet, right? Yeah. And I just when I read that, that's why I'm like, you know, these footnotes are so important to research. And I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that.
Well, this footnote I found in every book that referenced this sonnet, and it's all over the internet. And of course, it's incorrect. And so it's just that, you know, that kind of message again is don't believe everything you read, especially on the internet. And that, you know, you, it's really, you've got to dig into every single little thing that you see and verify it, you know. That's the message that I got out of there. And yes, and the, I think, you know, it's interesting because of that, because of me seeing how perpetuated that was, I realized it was really important to write this book because the true story wasn't necessarily getting out there.
I love it. I'm just going to open it up to anybody else who has a follow-up question or comment.
Yeah, I'll jump in here and say the last line of the sonnet that sent chills down my spine, and then make another separate comment that, you know, I think it's the conversation about not only the importance of following through and looking into the footnotes, but then not automatically believing that because it's in a footnote, it's validated, like, research is particularly important for the world we're living in today. And I love that that's all happening in the context of this conversation about a ridiculously important statue. And as far as I can tell, it's this, as a piece of art, it's the most revealing marble structure I've come in contact with. So that's a series of comments.
Wow, that's a wonderful comment. Yes. And I think, you know, as we continue the conversation, as especially as we get more into the statue next week, there's so many things here where misconceptions get out and they just get repeated. And it's really important to go back to the original source. And I'd just like to respond with one more thing about the last line of that sonnet. I mentioned that I wrote the Breaking Trail book with a folk singer, Peggy Lynn. She actually put that sonnet to music and sings it a cappella. And it is chilling. It is absolutely chilling.
Could you say her name one more time for me, please, so I can see if I can find that? Because that sounds amazing.
Peggy Lynn. And she titled the song To Inez. And, you know, I will look this up and put this on the sources for you.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sure.
Amazing. So you stumble upon this poem, doing your diligence on the footnote. And this all led. So your book was published in 2016, the suffrage statue book. I know you've written several books, but the focus of this show is this book, The Woman's Suffrage Statue. And that book was published in 2016. You can access the Amazon page for that book at our show resources page. And so you began, like, this first book, I think you said 2004 is when you published this book about the profiles of the 25 women.
Yes.
And so it's, you know, 12 years later, and you get a fellowship to study, I presume, the monument, but you receive a fellowship from the United States Capitol Historical Society. And was your plan to write a book on the statue, and that's why you applied for that fellowship?
Yes, that was my plan. I actually started doing research on the statue in 2008. I think it was the first time I went to DC and saw the statue, and I was immediately hooked. I was like, yes. And at that same time, I did some research at the Library of Congress, and I also talked with the curator of the Capitol, which was Barbara Wolanin at the time. And she was very enthusiastic about the project. And they had some, you know, they had some research there in their office. And I looked at some of that, and she said, you know, you really need to apply for this fellowship. And I'm, you know, I have two small kids and I've got another job, and, you know, and so life kind of got in the way for a couple of years, but I was still very, very excited about this project. And it wasn't until 2011, I guess it was, you know, I was considering completely quitting my corporate job, which was a part-time job, and moving to the Adirondacks. And so I applied for the fellowship. And as it turned out, the month that I was in DC for the fellowship was the month between moving from outside of Philadelphia to the Adirondacks. I spent a month in Washington. So it was a very interesting time.
Wow. So you first see the statue in 2008. And so like, can you just talk about that? Like, so you and I wasn't clear when you're doing this research on Inez and you stumble upon the poem, but do you remember what year that is?
That was probably 2002, 2003.
Okay. And so then you start doing research on the statue and you're like, I have to go see it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
So actually two of us on this show, Randy and myself, have seen the statue in real life. And we saw it, I think, Randy, it was 2017, maybe?
Yeah, in May.
Yeah, right. And it was very difficult for us. I don't know. I would like for you to talk about, like, the process by which you saw the statue, because for us, when we went in 2017, I actually gave a talk at the then called Sewall Belmont House on for Peace Day, which is May 18th, and talking about these linkages between the suffrage movement and the peace through law movement. And like, I asked them if they could arrange, you know, a special tour or it's like a special visit of the statue. And they said they tried, but they could not. And that we would have to book a tour, like just of the Capitol and do it that way. And so that's, and it was very upsetting because the tour did not stop at the statue. They take you into the rotunda. They point out some other statues, but not that one. And we had to kind of like go rogue and go to the statue on our own. And I was just wondering, was that the same experience for you, or in 2008, were you just able to walk up to the statue, or did you have a special visit planned and had special access?
No, I received the same treatment you did.
So you did, you had to go up to the statue on your own.
So we, I went and I had to go on the Capitol tour. Mm-hmm. And when you get into the rotunda, and different guides will take you to different things and point out different things in the rotunda. And I don't remember what our guide took us to, because I just ignored it and went over to the statue and started exploring it and taking photos. And I think I was politely told to please go back with my tour group. And I said, oh, just a minute. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, examined it as much as I could. And my tour group's like leaving the rotunda. And I'm like, no, just another minute. I'll be. So I stayed as long as I possibly could. But it is very, very secure. Even during my fellowship, when I went into the Capitol 5 days a week to go down to the architect of the Capitol curator's office, I could not just go up into the rotunda and study it, even though I was there to study that statue.
Wow.
I think I only went up one day. I went up, they had to have one of their staff go with me. And even when we went up, they did not really want us to go and look at it. And I thought, oh, we could stay for 20 minutes, whatever. And, you know, and after like 5 or 10 minutes, they were like, okay, you need to be like going on now. So yes. But I did get a chance to really explore it that time and to actually see Adlai Johnson's signature on it. To see the names carved into the back of it, to see little tiny details that you have to be looking for, actually, and be in a lot of different
a lot of strange positions because it's hard to get to the back of it to see it because it's near the wall.
Amazing. So I'm just going to open it up to see if anybody has any follow-up questions. Go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, I just want to point out that if you choose to ignore the tour guides long enough, some very not so kind armed officers will make sure that you leave the building, which we got to discover.
Right.
And that there was also, you know, other circumstances around our being escorted out, such as unfurling a flag. And we were told we can't do that. And this is so amazing because this is all before, you know, January 6, 2021, which, you know, the insurrection and the storming of the Capitol. The Capitol has been very much in the news these days. And there are, you know, security measures, I think, are just going to get worse. And so the accessibility to this statue is going to get harder and harder. But at least it's amazing, Sandra. I mean, you have this fellowship and you can't, like, it's very difficult for you to see it. I think that's incredible. anybody else? Michael, go ahead.
Thank you. So when you were doing, Sandra, for your research for the fellowship, since you had such limited access to the actual physical statue, was the primary sources you were using just like documents and archives, talking with the Capitol historians and stuff that would hopefully know about it if you sadly could not be up near the statue physically?
Yeah, so most of it was working with the staff at the curator's office for the architect of the Capitol. And they had files, of course, about it, of things they've gathered. So, I had those documents to look at. Probably the bulk of the time I spent at the Library of Congress with manuscripts collections. The Adderley Johnson manuscript collection has over 40,000 items. So that kept me busy. Besides another collection of her prints and photos and things, which most of those were actually off-site even, so I had to have those retrieved. And I also spent some time at the Smithsonian. They have what's left of some of her artwork, and they have her clothing collection and some other things that we'll probably talk about later. And of course, as we've mentioned, what was then the Sewell Belmont House. So I spoke with them a lot. They have a lot of resources, and they actually have the three of the original busts, individual busts of Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton that were done by Adderley Johnson in 1892.
Amazing. Did anybody else have a follow-up, Randy?
Yeah, I have one more series of things, I suppose. Okay. So despite the fact that the physical access to the statue is basically limited at best, as I understand it, even if a person was allowed to spend as much time as they wanted, you know, looking at the actual statue, there are parts of the story that are still like lost until you dig into the archives. And Hope has explained part of the story with the inscription, but Sandra, would you mind talking briefly about what the inscription is on the back of the statue, or perhaps what it was and maybe what it's going to be? Or I don't know the whole story of what it's going to become, but I know that something was taken away. Do you speak to that at all?
I think we're going to speak about that more next time, but I think what you're saying is absolutely. So there was a 238 word inscription that Adderley Johnson had stenciled on the back of the statue. And within the first year of it being down in the crypt of the Capitol, that was removed. And like I say, we'll talk a little bit more about that next time. But in regards to what you're saying in terms of research, there's no official record of what that inscription actually said. There's no photograph of it or anything. So you have to go through the papers to find out what did it actually say. And there is one newspaper article that actually says what somebody copied down. But again, it's one newspaper article. And as we know, you can't always believe what's in a newspaper. So you're absolutely right. I could stand there all day and look at that statue and I wouldn't know anything about the inscription. And so most of my time was spent actually going through Adderley Johnson's manuscript collection, which, as I said, is an enormous collection. She kept everything. She has diaries, letters, notes, speeches that she made, sittings that people did for models for sculptures, articles that she wrote, and any little scrap of paper that she happened to have at hand, she would scribble notes down. And there's these just scraps of paper with just little notes scribbled everywhere. And so there's all of these things there. And one of the things that I happened to come across there that she saved were her drafts of the inscription as she wrote it and changed it. And again, although the story has been that she just quickly scribbled it down and had it put on the back of the monument, it was something that she actually had composed over about 5 years. And so I could see her revisions of it over the years and how she changed it and you know what she was trying to mean and how she got at the final inscription. So it really is looking through those boxes and boxes and boxes of papers to find the items that give you clues about what you should look at when you look at the monument, when you do actually get to see it. Because what I find interesting is you can see even from photos from 1922, photos of the statue, and you can see that backside and you can still see where the names are carved into the marble. But then there's nothing underneath it anymore because what was underneath it was the inscription and that was stenciled in and that was removed. But you can still see those carved in names across the back of it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's an amazing story. And we'll get into that more later.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about the inscription more when we, but thank you for bringing that up. So there is an inscription. And I just want to also just say it now that in your book, Sandra, and you did this incredible, like, I just want to say, and I, you know, you said you, like, Adelaide Johnson has, I don't know, some 40,000 papers, okay, and scraps of papers. And I just want to again, like, commend you for being able to, like, look through this sea of information and then, like, find these nuggets and and weave the narrative that you do in this book. I mean, it's just like, please, if you haven't, you know, read the book, please do so. I've read it 3 times and it's a wonderful work of research and discernment. And one of the things that, so many things I've learned from your book, Sandra, I mean, it's like really an honor to talk to you today, 100 years later about the statue. But one of the things I learned from your book, thank you for going through her archives and unearthing this, is the fact that Adelaide Johnson, with the inscription, she put it on the back because she didn't want it to detract from, like, the staring of the faces. And she said something like, the thinker and the student will find it. Okay. Yes, and so that's yes. You know, that's that you did find it, right?
Yes.
And I just think that's so poignant and profound. And Adelaide Johnson says that you find it and there it is. And we have found the inscription, so to speak, or some version of it. So more on that when we talk about the statue. But let's go back to your research. So basically you're in DC for like a month and you're going through Adelaide Johnson's papers at the Library of Congress, the Sewell Belmont House, the Smithsonian, so many different pieces. And can you just share maybe one or two things that you found that became really, really important or otherwise just sort of, were important moments for you?
I guess following up on the sonnet question is I really went there with, you know, the intrigue of the sonnet and trying to figure out, was it really originally written about the statue? And I went through Edna St. Vincent Millay's papers at the Library of Congress. And once again, I was able to find her original proofs of the sonnet and that it was written to the pioneers. And, you know, I found even her like proofs for the book and her corrections and everything to actually show that, yes, she wrote this to the monument. And it was also kind of funny because Millay wrote a letter to her mother about it. And she said, well, I was down to Washington to this thingamajig, which the thingamajig was the meeting in the crypt at the monument. And she said something about like, you know, and I, you know, wrote this poem about the suffrage leaders, you know, Susan B. Anthony and a couple of other ones. And so it was like, she didn't maybe quite understand, but she got the message through in what she knows, which is poetry. I guess one of the other things at the Smithsonian that I was just absolutely intrigued with is as we learn more about Adlai Johnson, we'll learn that she was quite a character and that she had many talents. And one of her talents is that she was actually a seamstress. And she originally actually earned money to sort of get her artist training by sewing clothes for people. And at the Smithsonian, they actually have in storage some of the clothing that she made for herself. And including her especially famous capes. She had a real style of kind of this Greek, like, you know, classic fashion style. And so she would design and sew and wear these often long gowns and long, like, capes and things. And she would do exquisite needlepoint and design into these. And it was amazing for me to see her work.
Wow.
And I might mention maybe part of the reason she did that is because she was like barely 5 feet tall and 97 pounds. So maybe it made her look more regal. I'm not really sure.
Amazing. And I just want to, you know, go back to the first treasure, the, you know, the poem and the letter that you mentioned from Edna St. Vincent Millay to her mother. And I just, you know, we talk about research on this podcast. And, you know, we've talked about the footnote and doing your diligence, but also like the absolute necessity. Like, you don't just, one does not simply go into an archive, you know. You have to go with a very specific thing that you're looking for. And so you're like, let's like, it's this poem. And was it set on this day? And I myself have, you know, gone into archives with a very, very specific research question that still has not really been answered. But, you know, the importance of having that specific question and how much you learn from trying to answer it. I just wonder if you could speak a little bit about that.
Well, that was very true. I mean, in many of my early books, I was writing about very specific geographic areas. And so there was kind of limited information. So like, you know, every little nugget that I found, everything that I found was important, but it was a very limited amount of research. Whereas in this case, I had an overwhelming amount of resources to look at and to try to digest and to figure out, you know, what was important to my story and what perhaps wasn't as important, because you have limited time, no matter what. You have limited time of doing this. And so, you know, there's a catalog that kind of gives you a guide of, you know, the folders and the boxes and what might potentially be in there. But then, for example, in this case, you have all of her diaries for, you know, 50, 70 years worth. And you don't know what might be in there. Mm-hmm. What might you miss? And so I, you know, at some point I had to say, okay, so what might, you know, what are the important years to look at? What are the important days and things to look at? You know, and obviously February 15th, 1921, the day of the monument, you know, coming into being unveiled, and, you know, say, what did she say that day, you know? And so you have some certain days that you know you want to look at, but I did find myself sort of wandering around, and I don't remember the exact nuggets, but you know, I know that I just stumbled upon certain things by just looking at random days.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Anybody else before we move on to the next question?
I'd like to ask a question about basically the same subject. I mean, in the process of kind of semi-targeted exploration, because you know there's certain days you want to look at, but there are other, you know, these random sort of, like, I wonder what happened on Christmas of this year or whatever, like whatever set of ideas that motivates a certain kind of inquiry. I'm curious if there was anything weird that you found that you thought was like really cool that maybe didn't make it into the narrative. It didn't fit with the story you were weaving, but maybe it was like cool and worth sharing.
Oh boy, I'm trying to remember. Nothing jumps out at me at the top of my head. I know I was very intrigued with going through her photo collection to some extent, because it was amazing the photos that she had kept. And she had this habit of writing like long descriptions of what were in photos, which was fascinating because usually we have this photo and we don't know what's going on or who it is. But she would write these long descriptions of it. And of course, that's not really good for the photo, but it's very helpful for the researcher to find those kind of nuggets. Some of this is in the, I'm answering your question now. I did, something did pop into my mind also about in the research is she really didn't get along with Alice Paul, the leader of the National Women's Party. There were many nasty quotes that I discovered of things she said. A couple of them made it into the book, but she, you know, Emily Johnson had her funny ways and Alice Paul had her way, which were not those of an artist like Emily Johnson. So they came from two different ways. And so, you know, many times there was a lot of praise, but there were also other things of like, you know, Alice Paul telling Emily Johnson that, you know, you are queer. And she's like, no, I'm not. And well, yes, the way you dress is queer. Well, what do you know about fashion? You know, how long have you been around? So there were a lot of these little that I guess kind of surprised me because, you know, we get this kind of sanitized version of history all the time. And we don't maybe really realize that these are people. They have little spats. They have personalities.
I love that. And and so just to repeat what you said at the first part there, like, you know, yeah, they're people, but Adelaide Johnson was clearly one of these outrageously forward thinking people to know that somebody in the future would need a description of a photograph in a tremendous amount of detail, like that would be valuable. I think that says a lot.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think she knew that the things she had written about, the things that she saw, she was very, very aware of these were going to have a place in history. Mm-hmm. And I'm just amazed when I think of the fact that she lived from 1859 1859 is John Brown's raid of Harper's Ferry. Let me put it in that context. Okay. Prior to the Civil War, she was born and she lived until 1955. And so you think of the history that she saw during her lifetime, and very early on when she was first meeting Susan B. Anthony, she realized, you know, this was a historical person. These people are going to, you know, have a place in the changing of the world.
Yeah. Her sense of history and what John Lewis calls the spirit of history. I would be remiss. It's Black History Month, and John Lewis in his book Walking with the Wind, when he's thanking and acknowledging the persons, he begins with Martin Luther King, and he like goes through some other people, and he ends with the spirit of history. And as we'll get to when we talk about the actual, you know, the evolution of events behind the statue that's in the Capitol now, that, you know, this vision of having a statue in the Capitol. I mean, this is something that's decades in the making for Adelaide Johnson. It's just like from ground zero, once she starts sculpting, like this is going to go in the Capitol.
Yes, absolutely.
And it takes her like three decades for that to actually happen. And that's, yes. I'm getting chills talking about it, but she's like, yeah, she's very aware. And she understands her role. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just one of many amazing stories connected to this statue. So.
Well, and actually, that we're, I'm giving away the punchline.
Don't do it.
Ending here.
Not yet. No.
But I think what you just said is the message of the statue. It is about confronting the past, looking at where we are at the present moment, and looking into the future of where we need to go.
Nice.
Can I just say, for you, Sandra, to say that message, and then for me to have those mental images of the riotous mob in the rotunda, and to see the statue in the background, and oh my God, to have that juxtaposition of that message of that crossroads moment is just, that is a resonance on so many different levels. So I thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. It's been a very hard month for me. I feel very personally connected to the Capitol, you know, having spent time there, and some difficult days, yes.
On the subject of the images, I'm reminded of the image that Hope you showed me on numerous occasions of the oxen associated with like actually transporting this enormous piece of marble long distance. Like that's the image that's burned in for me right now. It's like, this is oxen.
Well, you know, fittingly, I believe the Chinese New Year is tomorrow and it's the year of the ox. So there it is. Okay. Can't make it up. Anyway, it's just amazing. So we've been talking about your research and the sort of like all of the stuff that goes into it, all the stuff that went into your book. I really didn't appreciate. I mean, I know it's the first sentence in your preface about the sonnet, but yeah, that's such an important torch, if you will, that's leading you into this further inquiry. And let's just talk about your book again, the woman suffrage statue, published in 2016. And so there's four different sections. And for the rest of the show, we're going to be really just focused on the first section. Adelaide Johnson and the Great Three is section one. Section two is a monument to women. Section three, an entity to be reckoned. And section four, take up the song, which we now know comes from the sonnet. And so how did you come up with that framework?
I don't know. I don't really start books with any kind of framework. And so this, I kind of let it develop. And I mean, of course, the story I really was going after was, you know, the monument, the making of the monument, the getting it into the Capitol, the unveiling, and how it was treated. But I realized there was, you know, as I started doing a lot of this research, that there's a much bigger story of the evolution of this monument. Because as we've kind of hinted at it, it really starts almost 30 years before the monument actually exists. And so, you know, I had to give that background into, you know, how this came into being. And I also came to realize more of the importance of the inscription and the connection of this statue to the Equal Rights Amendment, right? Mm-hmm. Which the Equal Rights Amendment was first proposed 2 years after the statue mm-hmm. was unveiled. So those became tied together. So I realized there were really so many more issues that the statue was a part of. Mm-hmm. And finally, since you know, I already gave away the punchline, since, you know, the message is kind of the unfinished work, that I've really got to talk about what's happening today and what's this unfinished work of the future.
Amazing. Anybody with a follow-up or otherwise some comment? Go ahead.
I'm ready to know what's coming next, you know.
All right. So next in like the evolution of the species or next in the dialogue?
Well, I don't know. It sounded like Sandra was ready to go somewhere there. And I'm like, you know, gripping the seat here.
Well, I think it's about time that we ratify the ERA, don't you? Not to get political here. No.
Yeah, we need to do several shows on the ERA because that is, you know, a very long history. Yes. 1923, as you said, so we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of that in a couple of years.
Yes.
Anyway, so, all right, let's talk about Adelaide Johnson a little bit more. So you've mentioned, and we've mentioned that she's, you know, very progressive. And I said at the beginning that my understanding is that it's really Adelaide Johnson's encounter with Susan B. Anthony that I think is so like, yeah, formative to the statue that's in the Capitol. And it's unveiled. I don't know if I said this, but the statue is unveiled on February 15th, 1921. So on Monday, that will be the 100th anniversary, but that's also Susan B. Anthony's birthday. So it was unveiled on Susan B. Anthony's 101st birthday in 1921. And so that's sort of a big clue that Susan B. Anthony's spirit, if you will, has a lot to do with this statue. And we're going to talk about other substantive linkages. But in your book, you talk about Adelaide Johnson's wedding, and that was in 1896. So that's 125 years ago. And even her wedding was planned to coincide with Susan B. Anthony's attendance at the National American Woman Suffrage Association. And so can you just, that this story about the wedding is really important. And on our school resources page, there's actually a letter from Susan B. Anthony to Adelaide Johnson about this wedding. So Susan B. Anthony was at Adelaide Johnson's wedding. And can you just tell us more about this moment?
Well, I just think this is like the wedding of the century. This is just an unbelievable wedding that she had. And she did plan it really around Susan B. Anthony being in Washington, D.C. for the conference. And Susan B. Anthony was just blown away by this wedding. After the wedding, she said it was the most beautiful wedding that she had ever attended. And there were some peculiarities with the wedding. And Susan B. Anthony told Adelaide Johnson not to worry about that people were going to think what they were thinking. And Adelaide Johnson had every right to do whatever she wanted. And she, in this letter that Susan B. Anthony wrote her after the wedding, Susan B. Anthony said, "I am glad you were married by a woman." Yes, she was married by a woman minister. "I'm glad you were married by a woman. And I am glad that for the first time in the history of marriages of our women's rights women, that one man has at last been found to give up his own name cheerfully and accept that of the woman he married." So what had happened is Adlai Johnson had kept this wedding a complete secret. And her soon-to-be husband, Alexander Frederick Jenkins, he went and changed his name to Johnson before the wedding. And so he became Alexander Frederick Johnson. And Susan B. Anthony thought this is just as it should be. Mm. And they were married by a woman minister, Reverend Cora Richmond. She was said to be in a trance as she performed this wedding. She was a bit of a spiritualist. And there were some people who thought that because they were married by a woman minister, that the wedding was not valid because you had to be married by a man. So this was the thinking at the time in 1896. But there's more to the wedding than that. It's astounding. First of all, Adlai Johnson changed her name on the marriage, or changed her age on the marriage certificate, because Alexander was 25 years old and Adelaide was 12 years older than him. So she was 37, but on the marriage certificate, she claimed to be 24. And the wedding outfits that they wore, her gown and his white suit, of course, were designed and made by Adlai Johnson. And for bridesmaids, she had the marble bust of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
I love it.
That's awesome.
And of course, they did not pledge to obey each other. And they also did not plan to live in the same house after they were married. They had separate residences. Hmm. Now, think of all that in 1896.
Mm-hmm. It's just incredible. And so you can read this letter that Susan B. Anthony writes to Adelaide Johnson on our show resources page, because I'm pretty sure, and Randy, you will appreciate this, that I think it was the president of the Theosophical Association that said, that criticized this wedding as being invalid.
Yes, I think you're right.
So in 1896, I mean, that would have been right in the weird transition period with the Theosophical Society. So I'm going to look in to see which one it was. That's compelling of a story, either, no matter who it was.
Yeah. I think the person's name is mentioned, maybe mentioned in Susan B. Anthony's letter. And it may be like the New York Theosophical Society, but in your book, Sandra, you do say that Adelaide and her husband, they shared an interest in theosophy. And so yes. Randy is, you know, very involved in the Theosophical Society of Detroit. So I just want to
shameless plug.
Yes. And I also want to say that Cora Richmond, who officiates, amazing, because and she goes to The Hague in 1907 and she speaks at the side event, as we would call it today, but the NGO of the day called the International Circle. They have these headquarters and all of these various intellectuals and activists and so forth gave talks, and Cora Richmond was one of them. So there's that as well. We always try to highlight these linkages between the peace through law movement and the suffrage movement. But amazing wedding. It doesn't last though, does it?
It doesn't. they do end up getting divorced in 1906, and they had kind of broken up, 4 or 5 years before that. But here's another one of those things that I don't know if I had ever read this in any of the books, again, until I was doing research and I found it I don't remember, and you know, in some of the documentation there, but it's actually a very sad story because they were married on January 30th of 1896, and Adlai Johnson actually became pregnant, and she had a miscarriage. And after that, you know, she turned to her art and he kind of turned to his job, and they just really drifted apart after that. So it's really kind of a very sad ending. And it also made me think, wow, if she had had a child, how would that have changed history?
Amazing. Anybody else before we move on to more about this encounter between Adlai Johnson and Susan B. Anthony?
Well, I mean, this is a sad comment. You know, maybe their marriage was a particularly strong one, but like the statistics for couples who lose a child together and the likelihood that they stay together are atrocious.
Yes.
The likelihood that you survive that kind of trauma, that kind of grief, that kind of sorrow is slim to none. So maybe it wasn't a marriage issue so much as a, you know, the universe had other plans kind of thing.
I like that idea. The universe had other plans. Yes. Yeah.
So when did Adlai Johnson first meet Susan B. Anthony?
So Adlai Johnson had gone to Rome to study to be a sculptress. And I can't skip over this story. I have to jump back a second. I just have to say, she did not come from a wealthy family. And she ended up going to Chicago and trying to make money as a wood carver, and had a little artist studio and was gathering funds, because at that time you had to go to Europe. You had to go to Rome to learn sculpture. And so she was saving up the money. And then one day she was hurrying back into her music, into her studio, which was in the music hall. And she ran in, and the elevator doors were open. And so she just stepped into the elevator, and the elevator wasn't there. She dropped 20 feet. She broke her femur. She broke one of her legs. She was just shattered. It took her a while to get her health back. And the doctor told her that her one leg would always be 3.5 inches shorter. And in the end, she sued the music hall company, and she got a settlement of $15,000. And that is what allowed her to go to Rome to study to become a sculptress. And she returned in 1886 from Rome, and she ended up in Washington, D.C. And her friend was involved with the National Woman's Suffrage Association. And so she took her to the convention and introduced her to Susan B. Anthony. And her friend said, well, you should have Susan B. Anthony sit for you and make a portrait bust of her. And what do you know? Susan B. Anthony agrees. And so she stays in Washington for, you know, a few extra weeks and sits for Adlai Johnson. And Adlai Johnson just thinks that Susan B. Anthony is just, you know, the greatest subject that she's ever had. She's very, you know, classical, and she's just very excited about this. And she has the model almost done, and Susan B. Anthony's about to leave, and they go to have lunch, and they come back, and someone has come into the studio and disturbed the cloth over the clay bust, and it's ruined. And so Susan B. Anthony immediately like takes off her hat and says, I'll just have to stay longer and postpone everything else. And so Adlai Johnson sculpts a new model in clay. And the next year she brings it to the National Women's Suffrage Association convention. And everyone loves it. But people notice that Susan B. Anthony's glasses are missing from her face. Now everyone still thinks it's wonderful. But Adelie Johnson, her motto is kind of, you know, perfection at every cost. And so the fact that anyone noticed that to her meant that she had not succeeded at actually capturing the spirit of Susan B. Anthony, because if she had, they wouldn't have noticed the glasses were missing. Mm. And so she's going to start all over again. do you want me to keep going?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. So she's going to Italy to work on another bust, and she takes along the existing Susan B. Anthony model to do some work on it while she's there. And she does create a new model, and she ships it back home, and she arrives back in DC, and she opens up the package, and the model is completely shattered from the shipping. And she didn't bring the other one back with her, so she has nothing to show. And she was hoping to show that model of Susan B. Anthony at the 1888 International Council for Women, their first meeting, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, and so she gives up for a while after that because she's very disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want to pause and sort of underscore this moment. This what happens here is so telling of Adelie Johnson's character and personality, that, as you said, perfection at any cost. And you know, she brings this quote unquote imperfect statue to improve upon when she's in Italy, and she wants to show it at the inaugural meeting of the International Council of Women in 1888. And this is an extremely important moment for us on this show and at the Cora Debrezza Foundation, because the International Council of Women, really, it's there where you have the Peace and Arbitration Subcommittee, from which we get the peace flag that we work with. But this was the 40th anniversary of the Seneca Falls, the 1888 meeting that Adelie Johnson wants to display her new statue of Susan at, but it's destroyed. And so there is no, I guess there was no statue at all.
Right, there was nothing, because she had left the first model she left back in Rome, and the second model was shattered.
Right. So, but she's there. She's there at the,
yes.
And that's amazing that she's there. So I'm going to leave it open to anybody to comment, question, if they have anything. Otherwise, we'll continue.
Okay. Nothing yet.
Okay. All right. So there's, I guess, a period of depression here. But then Adelie Johnson takes up the task of sculpting another bust of Susan B. Anthony. So can you tell us about that?
Yes. So now, about 1890, she hears that someone else, another artist, a man, is sculpting a bust of Susan B. Anthony to take to the World's Fair, which is scheduled for 1892 in Chicago at that point. It gets delayed until 1893, but you know, Susan B. Anthony and Adelie are both like, oh, this, we can't have a bust sculpted by a man for this woman leader. And so, you know, Adelie thinks, okay, I've got to go back to this project again. And she goes back to it. She starts having difficulty again, and she kind of like puts it aside for a little while. And then she has a vision. She has a vision that tells her that you have to go back to this. This is important, and you have to go do this. And so, of course, she listens to her vision. And Susan B. Anthony comes and sits for a new model. And that's in 1891. And she displays it at another convention. And everyone just says it is simply just perfect. No one notices that the glasses are missing. She has really, really succeeded this time. But she needs money to put this bust into marble. And no one's really offering her money to do this. And this will be something that plagues Adelie Johnson through her whole life, of never feeling that she's really getting paid for her work, or you know, being recognized enough for her work. But she keeps, you know, working at it, and Susan B. Anthony is so pleased with this bust, and definitely this is going to go to the World's Fair. But then Susan B. Anthony says, well, wait, I just can't even think of that I'm going to go to the World's Fair without a bust of Elizabeth Cady Stanton there with me. And so Adelie Johnson asks Elizabeth Cady Stanton to do a, you know, to sit for her so she can make a model so that she can take both of them to the World's Fair. And so eventually Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Adelie Johnson go to Susan B. Anthony's house in Rochester, New York. And the three of them spend a month together as Stanton is sitting for Adelie Johnson making this bust. And Adelie Johnson will say that this is the most incredible month of her entire life, to get to spend every day talking with Anthony and Stanton and hearing them reminisce about the old days, and to see them like receiving their mail and opening their mail, and you know, the different invitations or subjects that come in, and then they would all sit around and discuss it throughout the day. And Adelie Johnson would take long walks in the evening with Susan B. Anthony, and it really, I think it really impacted again her whole sense of history and what all of this meant. Mm-hmm. So she does successfully create this model of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And now we look at the, you know, look at the two busts sitting side by side, Anthony and Stanton, how lovely. And now Susan B. Anthony says, well, we can't go to the World's Fair without Lucretia Mott. Now, Lucretia Mott has passed away by this time, and Adelie Johnson really only sculpts, you know, in life, of live people. But she says, I think if we can get some photographs, I can do it. And so from the photographs, she makes a model of Lucretia Mott, and she's very satisfied with all three of these models. And in 1892, she goes to Rome to put these models into marble, because once again, Adelie Johnson insists on perfection. And so for all of her portrait busts, she has to go to Europe to get the best model and the best artisans to help her put her work into marble. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm just going to leave that by saying that when she gets to Rome, she sees the number 13 four times. She sees the number 13, and she takes this as a bad omen.
Amazing.
And she will have a lot of difficulty getting those three busts into marble.
Yes. So they do go to the World's Fair, though.
Yes? They do go to the World's Fair. Now, yes, it's a bit of a story of how they get there.
Yes. And it's page 36 of your book, where you have this photograph of the Gallery of Honor in the Women's Building at the World's Fair in 1893. And yeah, this is really like a logical place to stop today. And so I'll just, Michael had to leave for class, but Randy, final thoughts, comments, questions. We basically have been talking about really the first 20 pages in Sandra's book, The Woman Suffrage Statue. So, Randy.
Yeah, so you know, we started with this conversation about entering the forest, and Sandra was describing how she began her investigation into this set of stories. And I guess I just want to link back to that idea and say, you know, we're ending off at the World's Fair, and, you know, what happened in 1893 is something that just about everybody could have an interest in, because whether you're interested in, you know, architecture or, you know, spirituality or law or economics or whatever, like the World's Fair in 1893 is a story that has a bunch of things that are relevant to basically anyone. And the series of things that Adelaide Johnson and friends brought to the World's Fair tell these, like they're this window into the rest of the story. And so I'm looking forward to going into, you know, some of where that leads next time. And I'm thrilled to actually get to sort of reopen this cabinet in my mind, so to speak, and bring some of the moral energy back into my life that comes associated with this story, because it's an incredible statue, an incredible story associated with how it was created. And so, yeah, this window from 1893 is a cool place to enter through as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. And as we said, you know, it's really like when Adelaide Johnson starts this process of getting these statues, it's really at that moment. So like 1892, and I just, as you said, Sandra, it was supposed to happen in 1892, but the World's Fair didn't actually like happen until 1893. And I love this story as well, because it just shows you they're trying to get like the 400th anniversary of Columbus's quote discovery of America, which is 1492, but you know they can't make the deadline.
Right.
So it happens in 1893. I just love that. But it's at that moment, as we said in the beginning of this show, that she imagines these statues going in to the Capitol. And so, yeah, this is, as Randy's saying, like, this is a moment that it's like a portal to all of these things. And in particular, like one of the things, it's a portal into the statue going into the rotunda. And I also want to say, you know, this story about that you told, Sandra, that's in your book. And this story, I just adore this story about how these statues come into being. And it's Susan B. Anthony looking at her statue. And as you said, you know, I can't go to the fair without Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And then when Elizabeth Cady Stanton is sculpted, I can't go to the fair without little Lucretia Mott. And as you said, Sandra, you know, the story, like the meaning of the statue, it's not about individual people. It's about the work and the movement. And you see like that Susan B. Anthony, it's not about her, it's about this work. And that is that's why there are these three. And I just think that is something we need to hear. And in 1899, Susan B. Anthony, there's a meeting of the International Council of Women in The Hague, sorry, not in, in London. The Hague Peace Conference is going on at the same time, but the International Council of Women is meeting in London, and Susan B. Anthony is there. And it's there that she says there's too much focus on the I and not enough on the you, that we're too focused on ourselves and we have to be focused on others, the other. And I just think that's one of the things that the story about the statue teaches me. And I hope that we, you know, talk more about that next time, Monday, when we return. But Sandra, you have the last word for today's installation. So,
well, I was going to say yes. In recent times, Adelaide Johnson received a lot of criticism for choosing these three people, these three women. And again, when you actually look at what happened, when we actually go back and study the history, Adelaide Johnson did not choose these three women. You know, they were somewhat, you know, selected through Susan B. Anthony. Mm-hmm. And again, that really that month that she spent with Stanton and Anthony is when she began to realize that these three, Stanton, Anthony, and Mott, had really worked as a unit. Mm. And that without one, the others could not have done what they did. Mm. And I think, you know, that you kind of extend that to the whole statue in that, yes, it's representing these three women, but it's trying to represent all women, and really, as we look at it more next time, we'll see that she's really trying to represent all of humankind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think that's a really good place to end it for today. We will be returning with the second installment of this really important conversation about the woman's portrait monument to Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. You've been listening to Sandra Weber, who wrote the best book on the statue called The Woman's Suffrage Statue, which you can access on our show resources page. Thank you all. Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, Randy. And I look forward to continuing the dialogue in a few days on the 100th anniversary of the unveiling of the statue. So good night, and until next time.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandra.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.